Well, welcome back. I see a number of familiar faces. You almost didn't see mine, though. Somebody forgot to tell me they had blocked off an entire entrance at the one end of the Epic campus. So I came sailing on in and it had a big barrier saying no entrance anymore. So if you ever wondered why GPS is useful, I've got reason number one why it might be. So what I want to do today is, well, a couple of details to be taken care of. One of them is I promised for those of you who took 367 last semester to bring the graded final exams. So I've got those with me, and between sessions, you can pick them up if you'd like. I also have something to hand around, and that turns out to be the first assignment for this semester. And the good news is that it's very much based on the sort of 367 material that I covered last semester. Even if you haven't taken that course, if you had the equivalent, things like trees and lists and queues and that sort of thing, you're golden. And of course, experience in programming Java. This semester we'll be using Java again, and I assume most of you will be using Eclipse. That's not required. You're certainly allowed to use alternative. I know some people use Beans. There are still some versions of the old a Microsoft version of Microsoft language development tools. And there's the JDK, the Java Development Kit, which runs basically at command line, things like Java and Java C, where you can actually execute right at the command line. So it turns out that for fancier systems, it's better to use Eclipse. But Eclipse is, when it's a good friend, it's a very good friend. When it's not so good a friend, it's a real son of a gun. And if you don't believe that yet, you will by the end of this coming semester. So here, why don't you pass those around? Give me one. This gentleman's our TA, and I'll introduce him very shortly. So let me... Cool. Those of you who are very sharp-eyed will notice that actually it says 2015 down there. What happened is I found some cool software that converted all my old notes over to PowerPoint, but the thing it doesn't do is automatically change all those little footnote-type things. So I figured out how much time it would take to do it by hand, and I said, heck with it. So this is really 2016, and there's a little announcement there that makes it absolutely clear. The thing you want to get from this slide, of course, is the URL for the class webpage. That will have all the material that we'll need, assignments, homeworks, old exams, etc., and reading assignments and whatever. So be sure to copy that down if you already haven't. I'll get a little bit later. There's also a Piazza session that you'll want to look into, and when we talk about that, you'll if you haven't already signed up for a Piazza for this, be sure to do so. Let me also mention there's always the possibility of a little confusion. There are two sections of 536. We're in section number two. As it turned out, section number one's instructor, which is on campus, is out of town today, in fact, for the whole week, which is not a bad idea. So I got to teach the morning session also. So this would be like a day-night doubleheader, and we'll see how the second session works and whether my voice holds out for the entire length of the course, or the lecture at least. Wait a minute, what happened here? I had material here, it's gone, and I don't know why. So you know when the class meets because you're here, so maybe it figured out as an optimization on that you didn't really need to know where it is, but I'll have to figure that out. Sometimes fancy software is a little too fancy. At any rate, many of you know me, otherwise there's my email address. There's a telephone which is virtually useless because that's a landline that goes into the departmental receptionist and she may or may not be able to find me. So the best way to contact me is via email or through Piazza. I'll also, as in previous times, have regular office hours here. Our TA will also. So the office hours for me are Monday and Thursday, 5 to 7, in Enders, which I think is just down the hall a tad. If you're already not into it, one of the good ways of using office hours is essentially just as a study hall. Now, back when I was in high school, study hall was bad. You get sent to study hall when they catch you listening to the radio or reading a nasty magazine or whatever it might happen to be. But in this case, you can simply get away from your office, get in and work on your projects or your homeworks or whatever. And I or the TA, and for he'll also have office hours, will be available if a question pops up. If it doesn't, you just keep churning along. And when finally you decide it's time to get out of here and have some dinner or something, you're good to go. So that turns out to be a good innovation. I wish we could do that on campus, but on campus we don't have nearly the office space that you have. You have not much office space. You have plenty of meeting space, or at least it seems so. So on campus, I have a little office that seats two or three people. Here, I can put it in Ender's, and Ender's probably seats maybe 15 or 20. It's one of the larger meeting rooms, and therefore this idea of having a session where you just come in and work on your projects is a good one. It's not mandatory, of course. Work wherever you care to, and we can use Piazza also as a way to interact. But as I'm sure you realize, when you're trying to debug a program, having somebody to bounce ideas off of is a great idea. We'll be talking about compiling, but we'll also be talking about the design of languages. And it's one of these odd things that programming languages are designed to be easy to program, but it's also designed to be very precise in what they demand and what they require. I think probably computing or programming is one of the very few businesses where you absolutely have to have 100% accuracy. There are plenty of cases where you probably had some of them if you've done some programming, where your program was perfect except for one tiny little error. Might be something as simple as changing a period to a comma or vice versa. And that's enough to make a program invalid. And that's one of the things we'll talk about. Should that be the case? Should programming languages, on the definition end, be mucho strict? If so, it's harder to program. But then you have presumably more faith in the fact that if it gets past the compiler and the analysis, it's likely to be a valid program. That's certainly the case. Eclipse is sort of like that. Eclipse comes at you in a dozen different ways. Oh, this is invalid, this and then. You have to do a cast here, or you have to do a conversion there. And finally, when you get Eclipse off your back, you've got a much better chance that the thing will actually run and produce something meaningful. Other languages are much different. You can write down a program in a variety of ways, and it'll be accepted. But of course, it's also the case that you may write down something other than you intended, and the program will just simply go ahead and execute. So that's the downside of that. Okay, the TA is on. Here's our TA. I'll introduce him, Dylan. And he'll be having office hours out here on Wednesday. So we have things pretty well covered. Obviously, classes today on Tuesdays. My office hours on Monday and Thursdays, and his on Wednesday. Friday, you're on your own. You can take a long weekend, as far as I'm concerned. But I'm told many people who have to travel get away and either are traveling on Monday or Friday to sort of ruin your weekend along with part of your regular work week. So, in fact, some people, I know last semester we had one fellow who got sent to Abu Dhabi. Is he here? Did he survive that? Another person got sent to Miami, and that's not nearly as bad. A university in Miami, which is in a very nice area of Miami. Although probably the university hospital is not so nice. One of the downsides, I'm sure you already know, is that many universities have university hospitals where they do very advanced sort of medical procedures. But they always seem to be in the worst section of town, I guess. If you want to become an expert on gunshot trauma, it's best to be in a place where there's plenty of gunshot trauma. So that's one of the downsides. But anyway, Dylan, you'll be seeing. The way it'll work out is I'm going to be grading the exams. He'll be grading the projects. Turns out, unlike 367, we won't have a ton of homeworks. We'll have one homework in the middle of the semester that handles some of the theoretical aspects of the course. Other than that, we'll have five projects, the first of which went around today, and I'll be talking a little bit about that, that comprise the components of a compiler. And deeper in today's lecture, we'll get into that. So, Dylan, you're welcome to stay, or you can scoot out of here if you can find your way out or something. That's right, you did 302 this summer, right? Yeah. So you're getting a lot of people here with...
no bribes, unfortunately. We had an ethics class about that.
Otherwise, bribes? I mean, Doug, you're buying the entire university. We're talking about bribes in this situation there. You pretty much own us already, so... Remember, I'm out here. You're not on campus, right? So that's got to tell you something. So here's a list of key dates, and these may be a little bit flexible, but given that you have to travel, it's always a good idea to have something in mind. The main dates are project assignments, but as I'll get to later, even though a project's due on a particular day, you have as much as a week lay time, but we will penalize you, kind of like IRS. If you hand in your taxes later, they'll still take your money, but they'll take a little bit extra to go along with it. So there are various projects, and I try to spread those around the semester. The usual semester is 15 weeks, but the way we have set up, that means 15 lectures in this case. There's 1 week, I think it's actually Holy Week, where that's officially spring break. So I won't have a lecture on that day. So actually, 15 lectures will be spread across 16 calendar weeks. But on the, since you're not on campus, I assume most of you don't follow spring break campus-wise, so not like you're going to be going to Galveston and seeing if you can get the best tan and the worst hangover that ever was imaginable. So in that case, I'll still have office hours, and there actually may be assignments due. It's simply that because of the rules, our classes are not in session, there won't be a lecture that particular day, but the rest of the week will be pretty much normal. Also, something we do regularly is, because many of you are traveling on company business or you have your long-awaited sabbatics coming up or whatever, there are two sittings of the midterm and two sittings of the final. You do not have to take both. In fact, you may not take both. If you take one, then that one counts and the other one won't. But you'll be allowed to choose when you want to. And the idea is they're roughly a week apart, so that if you have business travel, hopefully the travel is not so extensive that you miss both of them. If you do, we may be able to work something out. Last semester, we had somebody who was traveling somewhere, and I guess while he was waiting for his plane, he simply had a copy of the exam printed out. He wrote it up and found some sort of scanner or something and emailed it on in. We don't want that to be the norm, but business is important, and you have to be sure if you're assignment is to be out of town on a particular day to try to fit it in with classwork. So there's two sittings of the midterm and two sittings of the final. You can take whichever one you want. You do not have to tell me in advance. All that happens is I'll get a head count just so I know how many exams to print up. But if you decide to come on the first one, come. If you decide that, oh no, I need another week's reprieve or something. So it's sort of like being on death row where you get a reprieve and hope maybe you'll get another and another. But at any rate, you take either of those. And this semester turns out we're ending up pretty early. Classes will be pretty much over by early May. Now, something you may or may not know about, you should because you kind of pay for it, is there's an annual tradition where EPIC and Computer Sciences have a picnic out here on campus. EPIC, of course, pays for everything. And the cool thing is, and I didn't even realize this until later, is that they serve mucho good cuisine. Usually they have steaks, lobster tails, sautéed asparagus, etc. And I always thought, hey, this is the way these guys eat all the time. And then I came out here and they told me about Taco Tuesdays and what is it, Hamburger Fridays and all that, where you eat pretty much a proletarian type food. But since you're students, you're more than welcome to attend, and I'll tell you about that. And since you're helping to pay for it, which means your labors earn the income and the profit, which pays for all this, you're welcome to come as a student. And many students, particularly the heftier types, one steak is not enough. And free lobster tails, I mean, most guys don't get free high-quality food, so when somebody dishes it to you, you are more than welcome to take it. And when EPIC is hiring you, they take you out to a nice restaurant to kind of seal the deal and say, you know, oh, you join us up, you know, you'll be going to L'Etoile or wherever it is. As L'Etoile came out and made a branch, L'Etoile is a very good restaurant on State Capitol Square. And if you ever get them to give you food out here, take it. Believe me, take it. So let's continue on. And again, if I have to change those dates, I'll warn you in advance. But again, just put that on your calendar, tentative things, particularly for the exam, so you know you'll want to be in town for one of the midterms and one of the finals. People are asking, is there a textbook? And the answer is yes, there is. I'm told there's a little library somewhere on campus. Where is the library? What building is it in? Oh, okay, makes sense, the original building. And is the joke here correct that you know that you had a little bit of an accident, there was a fire and both books were burned and one of them was only partially colored? So, nah, that's an old joke and it doesn't fit here. But anyway, here is the textbook, Crafting a Compiler. I happen to know all three of the authors very well, and at least two of them I can say they're gentlemen and scholars I highly recommend. The third guy I'm not at all sure about, so He tends to be a little bit shifty, so I'll warn you about him if you ever have to come in contact with him. But you have you can look at the book if you want. There should be some old copies floating around. We used this last time I taught it. And again, I think there is a copy in your library that you can take a look at. Or you can actually take the plunge and decide if you need a second mortgage or anything and actually buy the book. Textbooks are one of those things that are getting more and more expensive when they ought to be getting less and less expensive. But, you know, that's business, and I don't understand that fully. Since we have a textbook, the reading assignment are chapters 1 and 2 of the book. And that's essentially just background and history, some of which I'll talk about today. Later on, there'll actually be chapters that talk about scanning and parsing and so on. And those will really come in handy in that my notes will cover the main ideas. But as you always know in a textbook, there's more detail. There's some sample questions at the end of a chapter, etc. Things of that sort. Also, class notes will be available. That's what I'm actually lecturing from right now. And that should be on the class webpage under lectures. So some of you, presumably, I sent out a Piazza message warning you that that was available, and some of you probably have gone ahead and printed it. This is standard PowerPoint. It means you can use the usual PowerPoint thing of printing several per page with some notes area on the side, etc. So all that will be useful. Also, it turns out that since I have this document camera, which I'm eager to try, in many cases I write up some handwritten things, and I'll do this a little later in today's sessions. This would be about the project. And what these things are, I actually have these scanned, and these are actually on the webpage also as supplemental notes. So if you wonder what those are all about, in this case, since I only meet once a week, normally on the second lecture, if I was doing two or three lectures a week, I would talk about the project, having given you time to look over the definition and come up with some good questions. But since I won't see you again after today for another whole week, unless, of course, you come to office hours, it's something where I want to talk a little bit about the project in advance, just to warn you what it's all about. The goal of it is to get you familiar with some of the terminology and data structures we use in compiling. But again, if you've taken 367, and I see a number of familiar faces who have, this is really just a data structures type assignment, not all that much different than what you did last semester's. If you didn't take that course, you're not doomed at all. It's pretty straightforward in terms of the concept. What you're going to do, as I'll show you, is we're going to give you a tree, a very special tree called an abstract syntax tree that represents the meaning of a program as far as the compiler's concerned. A compiler doesn't see a program as a series of characters or words. It sees it as a tree. And a tree has all the components that you expect in a program. There are declaration parts, there are statement parts, there are method parts, there are expression parts, etc. And a tree says precisely what are the contents of those statements and what are their parameters. So what we're going to do in this assignment is walk the tree. That is, we start at the root, because all good trees have a root, and that typically represents the entire program, and walk down the tree looking for something fairly simple, namely declarations and uses of identifiers. The reason for that is if you look at a textbook, one of the things a textbook tends to have is an index in the back of the book saying, okay, you were talking about Weibelfitzers. Here's the page where Weibelfitzing or Weibelfitzers were defined, and here's where they're used. And it actually turns out that compilers and particular support systems like Eclipse do something very similar, where they say, okay, here's the definition of ABC. It was declared on line so-and-so, and its type was such-and-such. And then what it does is links together all the uses of that identifier. That turns out to be very handy, because one of the things that sometimes happens is you have to change the some details of a declaration. For example, an array may have to have its size changed, or a class may have to have some fields added. And what it does then, it finds all the places where that's used and lets you decide, okay, I changed this definition, how do I change this use, if at any? There's also something that exists that you may never have used, but turns out to be pretty cool, called refactoring. Refactoring is one of those crazy things where in computing you always have a problem. Do I choose an existing word that's used in English? In which case I have the overhead of understanding that the technical term may not mean exactly the same as the English language word does. Or I can create a brand new word like refactoring. I don't think refactoring ever existed before computing did. But of course that means you don't understand what it means. Kind of re usually means doing something again, and factors, kind of like mathematics, you know, factoring an expression. But refactoring it essentially allows you to do is systematically change all the definitions and uses of a particular declaration. One of the ways that I use that, and you may if you're not a very good typist, as I'm not, is when I'm declaring an identifier, I ought to give it a really cool name, like the cost of one dozen objects. But who's going to type all that? I'll die of old age doing that. So what I do is I do a declaration with a very small abbreviation, like TT or something, and then I refactor it back to the full name after I've got it all programmed up, letting the computer do all the extra work. So that's a simple way of doing refactoring. And if you think about it, the data structure we're building is ideal for that. It says find the declaration and all the uses in a program and change the one name into another. Now, refactoring is actually more powerful because it can do something that you may have had trouble with but happens all the time. Namely, you have a method that has some number of parameters. And all you're saying, oh my gosh, this type is wrong or I need another parameter. What do you do currently? You find the declaration and all the uses and change them one by one by one and hope you don't screw up. Refactoring allows you to do that in a much more systematic way, saying I'm going to remove a parameter, I'm going to change the type of a parameter, I'm going to add a new parameter, and I'm going to do it systematically. It's still not necessarily trivial to do. If you have a new parameter, you have to figure out what to do with it. But at least it systematically says, here's the spot where it's declared, here's the spot where it's used, and these are all the places where things need to be changed. So this notion of refactoring and this cross-reference we're doing is really a very handy thing. Our purpose, though, is mostly just to get you familiar with the data structures and the terminology that we'll see in compiling. So the sooner you're comfortable with that, the easier the rest of the semester will be. So we'll get to that. I'll probably do that in session 2 or 3. Piazza. Again, if you took 367, you use Piazza. If you've taken other classes, you probably use Piazza. Everybody who is registered on my list as of about a week ago, whenever I sent out that message, should have gotten a message from Piazza saying, hey, would you like to sign up, be a member? If you're signed up and you hadn't gotten a message, that means I probably don't have you yet on my list of official class members. What you probably want to do is between sessions, come up and see me, give me your name and particularly your email. I can go into Piazza, add some new people, and you'll get a message. And that'll tie you into the wonderful world of Piazza. Why is Piazza cool? Well, again, if you used it, you know why. And it's really a very good way of having the instructor, me, the TA who you met, and all the rest of you interact on a shared basis. Since this is a fairly advanced class, it's a 500-level class, and you're all professionals in the true sense of the word, I'm going to allow you a good deal of freedom in terms of helping people out. It's perfectly legal for somebody saying, okay, the deadline's coming up, and I'm running this piece of code, and it just isn't working. It ought to be working, but it's not. Can anybody tell me any ideas of what I did wrong? That's acceptable. What's not acceptable, and I'll get into cheating policy a little bit later, is simply saying, oh, I had a wild weekend over at the Super Bowl, and I am bombed out. Fisher wants this assignment. Please give me a copy to hand in to him. Obviously, he's not going to do that on Piazza if he thinks Fisher is watching, but if you see something like that, that is not allowed. So you're allowed to answer reasonable questions, explain things. If somebody says, I don't understand what these Weibel-Fitzers are all about, you can explain in your own way what your take on it is. The only thing I'll request is don't give an answer unless you're reasonably sure it's correct. By all means, don't give bad answers, bogus answers. You're not pre-meds. This is not a class where if one of your colleagues does badly, that helps you out. This is more cooperative. You're all partners, and most of you are EPIC employees. Some of you aren't, but you're all professionals. And I want you to help each other out. That's the way real computing is done. It's really crazy where sometimes you can look at a problem a dozen times and there's an obvious flaw that you just don't see. But somebody else looking at it says, dummy, you forgot to declare that, or this is the wrong value, or whatever it happens to be. You fix it and life is good again. So we want cooperation, and Piazza is a great way of doing that, particularly in the case where if you're pulling an all-nighter or something to get something done and there's some other students around with you, I'm probably in bed sleeping and I'm not going to be answering you, but somebody else may still be out there to help you. So it's kind of like the late programmer's helpline or something. Help, help, I fall down, I don't know how to get up again programming-wise, and they'll be able to help you. So here's the academic misconduct policy. This is more in my notes for when I'm teaching undergraduates. I'm treating you like graduate students. That means adults who are in the class because you want to be, not because you want to figure out what's the least amount of work I can do to get an acceptably passing grade. If you're in doing this, you're silly, you're wasting the company's money and some of your own money. I understand now that Epic is not giving you 100% anymore. So you got a little bit of your own cash in online too. So you don't want to waste that. So unless you force me to, I don't expect this will ever be a problem. But if the TA comes in and says, these two individuals handed in what looks to me like virtually identical code, and they're not partners. I'll get the partners in a moment. Partnerships are allowed in all the projects because I like people to work together. Obviously, if you're partners, you trade code all the time. But if he happens, and it may be by chance, or it may be there are programs around that actually take sources and compare them. And they say, well, let's look at this program and that. If you have an AST, for example, you can compare the structures of the tree. Does it just happen to have the same number of methods? Do the methods just happen to have the same number of parameters? Is the size of the code in terms of number of statements virtually identical? Things, you know, that says, you know, if it looks like a duck and walks like a duck and quacks like a duck, maybe it's a duck. And we have those programs. I don't know that he'll use them, but I don't know that he won't either. So don't tempt him and don't tempt me. Programming and homework assignments, late policy. There'll only be one homework, and I haven't set the date for that yet because it depends a little bit on how much material I get in the various lectures. But at some stage when we're talking about things called finite automata and regular expressions, they're in the textbook. You can take a quick peek at those at some point if you care to. There'll be some assignments that are more of the pencil and paper variety. Not all much different than 367 where you had to draw a data structure and link this and link that. Now it's a specialized kind of data structure, but we'll actually be doing something like that. And there'll be the regular five programming assignments. They'll all be due on such and such a date. If they're handed in by midnight of that date, you're fine. Otherwise, we'll accept them up to a week late. We can't accept them much later because at some point the TA may be handing out sample solutions or something. And obviously, once the solution is out, we're not handing in any new hand-ins on that assignment. But like everything else, there'll be a little bit of interest there. For each day late, it'll be 3%. A week is 7 days, so that's a maximum of 21%. That's just a way of kind of reminding you, please don't get yourself too deep in the hole. You can always say, well, he says it's due March 14th, but I got a week, so it's really the 21st. Well, yes, that's true. But if you let it wait till the 21st and something screws up and it, all of a sudden the 22nd comes, you know what the problem is. So it's always the case where you want to use your time effectively, and this gives you some flexibility. It's fair to you, and I think it's also fair to the other students who are working hard to hand things in on time. Grade weights. Everybody likes to know how much things count. I did something similar to this last semester in 367, and people took things a little too literally. What happens is, if these percentages are in fact accurate, or pretty close to accurate, I may twiddle by a percent or two. But last semester, what people in some cases did is, they simply took their grade times the weight and got a composite grade. And it turns out grading is not quite that easy. What happens is for the two exams, and sometimes for the homework, I do something called scaling. What scaling is, it says not all exams are equally hard, as I'm sure you've realized. And if I just took the raw grade that you got in an exam, that would be a little misleading. For example, you might get a 60 on an exam, and you look down and the average score was in the 40s. Well, wait a minute, if most people are doing it in the 40s and you got a 60, out of 100, that's really not a bad grade. You're probably very close to the top. On the other hand, if you got a 60 and most other people were getting 80s, now the grade is not all that good. In fact, it's pretty poor. It's below most people. So scaling takes into effect the fact that the difficulty of an exam can vary from one exam to another and adjust based on how do you stand vis-a-vis the other folks. So if you're doing about as good as someone else, that's fine. If you're above, that's very good. If you're below, that's not so good. And scaling takes care of that. I have a program that does all that, so be forewarned. This will give you a good estimate of where you stand, but it is not a guaranteed predictor of your final grade. So, again, that's something there. And as you can see that some of the programs are a little easier than others. Program 1, for example, I think is a tad easier. Most of the other programs are a little harder, and therefore they're worth a little bit more. Turns out, I'll get to this later, but one of the cool things about a compiler is that you don't have to program all of it yourself. We actually have tools that are kind of like programming robots. And that's pretty cool. We're getting started getting to the point where we have robots. I know somebody had one of these things that cleans your floor. What is it called? A Roomba? And it kind of sweeps around. But this poor person had a cat. And this cat hated the Roomba with a passion because the cat would be deep asleep under a bed or something and the Roomba would come zooming at it. And the cat usually wakes up. I mean, cats don't sleep all that deeply. But, oh boy, did it hate that Roomba. Well, we're not going to be doing vacuuming type things, but actually we can write programs that write components of a compiler. That is, it'll generate the Java code you need for your project, but you don't write the Java, or at least not all of it. What you do is you write rules. And that sounds pretty cool, the situation. I simply say, Mr. Program Generator, here's what I want you to do. But if any of you have been around, particularly if you're in quality assurance, as I know some of you are, telling what a program's supposed to do is one of the hardest things in the world. What's right? What's wrong? What's acceptable? Even something as simple as suppose you just had to do something that screened mailing addresses. Say you're writing out a newsletter. In a lot of cases, if you know you're like me, you end up getting multiple copies of things like catalogs or newsletters or something. In fact, an old trick, there used to be that if you subscribe to magazines, and this is back when magazines were paper, not just images on your screen, they would sell your name to various companies to try to sell your products. So what I would do is when I wrote my name down, I would change my middle initial to say that you got my name through this particular thing. So if I was going to Atlantic Monthly, it'd be Charles A. Fisher. If it's Harper's Bazaar, it's Charles B. Fisher, and so on. And it was always interesting to end up seeing who sold your name to these catalog people, because when your name came on there, the middle initial would tell you where they got it from. So it's something like that. And so even something as simple as saying, okay, just look at these name mailing addresses, and are they the same? If you have a middle initial with a dot, is that the same as the middle initial without a dot? It sounds like that, but there was at least one fairly famous person who had a middle initial without a dot. There must be several. Do you know the one I'm thinking of?
Probably Harry S.
Yes, the man knows exactly. It turns out S was his middle initial, but it was not S as an abbreviation for someone like Simon that began with an S. You knew part of it. What's the rest? Why was it S without a dot? Exactly right. They had two relatives, and when you have a child, you probably already know that if you're at the point where you start having a family, naming the child after a rich relative is a great idea, because sometime in future, the child's going to need college money or going to want money to start a home or to buy a car or something, and you say, hey, Uncle Simon, I named little Simon after you. Don't you want to help him out? So in this case, he got two for the price of one, but becoming president, he was a pretty honest guy in a pretty corrupt system, so he was rather different. Oh, I didn't know that. Cool. And if he's working here, he could be Cash or Charge, right? Yeah. Or Cache, I'm sorry. Blech. So that makes more sense. So at any rate, we'll be using those tools, and I'll get to them. And this is an ongoing part of development in computing, is how can I have computers do specialized work very precisely and very automatically? And we'll get into that, at least in the area of compiling. Partnership policy is, as I said, you can work by yourself if you like, or you can have one partner. And that's purely up to you. I'm not going to, you can write, little notices on Piazza. I'm looking for a partner, situation, good coding skills or requirement, et cetera, whatever you want, just like you're doing an ad. Some of you in the past, if you had partners and you want to reuse the partners from previous semesters, that's fine. If you want to break and have somebody fresh, that's okay too. What happens, of course, is in a partnership, you both get the same grade. I never listened to all those things. I did 90%, he or she did 10%. Give me a good grade, give that person a bad grade. Now it's pretty much like a divorce court where you're deciding who gets the cats and who gets the dogs and who gets the cars and all that. But what can happen is if in one of the partnerships you work with somebody and they turn out to be disappointing, you're not required for the remaining projects to continue working. You can simply say, that's it, I'm done. You did not work out as a good partner. In future, I'll take a different partner or I'll work by myself. That's acceptable. But It's the obvious sort of thing. If you work with a partner, you get the advantages, but also the disadvantages. Okay, that's about all the overhead of the class, overview of the class. Any questions about who knows what? I'm going to get into some more detail about what you're doing, but essentially the projects will be 5 projects written in Java, some of which will have tools which actually generate part of the Java for you automatically. The downside of that, of course, you have to learn to use the tools. Not only do you now have to know how to use Java, you'll have to use things like JLEX and JavaCup, which are tools that actually generate scanners and parsers, meaning they actually generate code, which is in Java, which when compiled will do scanning or parsing. But you don't generate all the code yourself. You generate rules that say, I'd like you to do this or I'd like you to do that. You figure out how to do it, you code it, and I'll use it. So when it works out well, it works out very nicely, and that's one of the things I want to introduce you to. So compilers, of course, are very fundamental. The reason for it is even if you use a fairly non-standard language. Here it's Cache, right? It is one of the big languages, and that's pretty much an in-house language as I understand it. There are not too many other people that use it. There are more mainstream languages like Java, C, C++, and I imagine some of your other projects are done using the more mainstream languages. This company, like many others, are getting into apps. And apps use what? What do the apps here use? Objective-C or anybody know what the coding base is? Java is used for some of them, and there's variety. So it turns out the source language doesn't really matter that much, nor does the target machine. It turns out that different computers have different processor chips built in. Many laptops and desktops, like you're in front of, use Intel chips of various sorts, and they all implement what's called the x86 interface. But it turns out many tablets and smartphones use chips by a company called ARM, A-R-M, and they have a different architecture. And one of the things that compilers do, and let's take a little picture of that, is allow you to hide the details of how the translation works inside the compiler. So you could, for example, have a particular product, which is written in, say, Java, just for simplicity, and it prints out output. Turns out, actually, Java has its own machine language called JVM, Java Virtual Machine, but you can also convert languages like Java into actual machine instructions. Some of them could be for the x86 if you had a laptop-type product, or it could be for some variation of the ARM processor if you had a tablet or a smartphone was your target. And the cool part is the program itself would not have to change. The compiler would have to change, but not the program. So that turns out to be very valuable historically. That was not the way things began. And we learned through many painful years of episodes that what we as programmers wanted and what various companies who developed compiler software and computers wanted something very different. So the compilers are translators going from a human-oriented language to the machine-oriented language. We'll talk a little bit about the machine language. We talked a little bit about it at the end of last semester if you were in 367. But it turns out that machine instructions are very fundamental and very detailed. So let me get some paper here. Oops. Yeah, there we go. So it turns out that at the lowest level, we are used to having a programming language at a fairly high level, like A gets B plus C. And that's an assignment statement with an expression that's fairly common. Certainly, you see it in Java, you see it in C, C++. I assume probably something similar to this is in Cache also. Is that correct? Those of you programming. I mean, it's so fundamental that it's just there. But what actually happens is when you get down to the actual machine, instructions are very, very fundamental. Usually a machine instruction, and again, it doesn't really matter that much which processor you use, is something as simple as do one add, or one do one load, or do one store, or do one branch. A branch changes the location of where you're executing. So a branch would be used, for example, to choose between a then and an else if you had a conditional. So each one of these are low-level instructions. And what happens is all programs end up at this very low level. And it kind of strikes people that the detail or the unit of computation is so very minor, so very fundamental. But what really makes this all work is that computers are immensely fast. It's so fast that even I've been in the business longer than I care to admit. Just you lose track of just how much power is there. It's a power not in the complexity of the instructions, but the number of instructions they can throw at you. So it's a situation where if you have enough instructions, even if they're doing a little bit at a time, it's almost like a grain of sand, another grain of sand, and all of a sudden at some point you have a beach. So just as an example that I mentioned this last time, but it's always good to remember, is that one of the ways that processors are measured these days is by their cycle rate, their speed. If you're buying a new computer, one of the things you can say, I'm going to get an Intel processor that is, for example, 3 gigahertz. Now, hertz is cycle, giga, that's with an I, means what? You have all these prefixes, there's kilo and mega, and what's giga? Billion. So this is saying its clock rate is 3 billion cycles. The reason that's important is that modern processors, if you have the right program, can issue and execute instructions at the rate of at least the clock speed. So in this case, if I'm doing 3 billion cycles per second, I could, in theory, execute 3 billion instructions per second. Now, 3 billion as compared to what a person can do. Usually a person can't do very much in a fraction of a second. I think gamers have a rule what that if you have a highly reactive game, you want the game to react within a few tenths of a second. So if you're doing something where you have a joystick or something, and you're saying, move here, move there, shoot now, duck now, or whatever. If the thing reacts within a tenth of a second or so, that's acceptable. Because that's the perception of, you know, how fast that people can notice certain things happening. But just think of that. Even if it's a tenth of a second, that means in that tenth of a second that you can barely notice at your threshold, it's doing 300 million instructions. They're very low-level instructions, but part of the power of computing then is if I have enough low-level instructions grouped together properly, I can do some very major tasks. And that's why games, for example, can be as intricate as they are and as interactive as they are. Down at the low level, they're doing very fundamental operations, but you're doing so many of them so fast that you can, in composite, have a very, very complex system being simulated or implemented. So let's go back. So at this stage, this is the stage where you came into the class. You all knew about compilers of one sort or another. You take a program, run it through the compiler checks it out to see if it's workable or not, and then finally a translation comes out which is executable. Some systems will execute immediately. For example, you can have something like Eclipse immediately execute your program after compiling, or you can translate the program into a form that's stable and ship it. That's, for example, how your products are done. I assume what must happen is you have a source for a program, you end up translating into a form, and then put it on, however you transfer your programs, either put on a website that's password controlled, or maybe put it on a flash drive, or burn it on a CD or a DVD that's getting kind of old, but it's still done, or if you're really, really old, put it on a magnetic tape. Do you have any products that go out of magnetic tapes? Not anymore, but they used to be. It used to be, you know, you'd have these huge packages that were shipping out and they were mag tapes. And I remember the mailing people and the secretarial staff hated it because they never fit into the slots that you had. You know, they tried to jam the darn thing in, and these were pretty big tapes. I think they were probably about the size of an old-fashioned record, maybe 11 or 12 inches in diameter. And you know, but that's how you ship programs. You get a brand new tape and you'd mount it on your computer and read it off the tape. That's changed, but the notion of translating a program into a form, transferring it, and then using it at a later time is very fundamental. So one of the nice things that I've been kind of scooting around, but now it's pretty clear, is the good thing about a compiler is if you understand a source language like Java or Cache or C or C++, the details of the machine are irrelevant except to the compiler writer. That means the program you write should be able to run on any reasonable computer system. reasonable meaning that it has, for example, Java implemented on it. These days, Java is implemented on virtually everything because Java is used as a way of embedding programs in other media. For example, it may be the situation that you have something like JavaScript, which is not full Java, but that is something which allows a web page to be animated. There used to be something that people talk more about but still exists called applets, which are things that are part of a download, and they would do some intermediate level of computation. So you could actually, you've probably seen this where I say you're thinking about taking out a loan, and you fill in various things, and it figures out the parameters. You know, if I want to borrow $10,000 and pay it back in 60 months and pay an interest rate of 3%, what's my monthly payment going to be? If I pay more, how much sooner is it going to be paid down? These are honest-to-gosh computations, and there's actually little programs that do it, but these aren't immense programs, you might imagine. It's usually a fairly modest amount of code that does the arithmetic for compound interest and all that. But if you have various little program snippets, those actually have the same form, where you don't care exactly how the snippet is executed as long as you know how to write the source program and have it be correct and acceptable. So this turns out to be a fairly major thing. In the old days, when you were a programmer, you were not just a programmer. You were a programmer who worked on one particular machine. I know I had at least one student whose mom worked for IBM way back in the 60s and 70s. And in those days, IBM worked real, real hard to chain you to IBM. So IBM computers were operationally different than other computers. Why? Well, because they don't want you to change. More than that, even the software was not interchangeable. There was no notion of something like Java that runs on different platforms. You could have a compiler for Fortran or COBOL or one of the existing languages back then, but it probably would not accept everything that one compiler did and the other. They weren't totally standardized. In fact, one of the dumbest, it's so dumb it's hard to believe, is that back in the 1960s, they created a language called, called ELGOL 60. Can anybody guess what the 60 means? That's when it was actually defined. Ooh, that's a long time ago. That's 50 years plus. And they said this was going to be an international standard language. Everybody's going to be able to write programs and exchange them. Cool. Everybody loved it. This is particularly scientists. You know, I could be a scientist in Germany and come up with some code and ship it to the States and they could try it out and get some feedback, etc. They standard everything but one feature. Can anybody guess what the one feature they didn't standardize was? You're not going to believe when I tell you, but it's true. I/O. It turns out that means that the way you would, for example, read a tape or print out a listing or something would be machine-dependent or system-dependent. Now, why do you think that's such a bad idea? It means I can send you a program, but you can't read anything into it, and you can't print anything out of it on my machine. Oh, great, isn't that the world's greatest program? See no evil, speak no evil, do no evil, et cetera. So what you'd have to do is go in and take the program, find all the places where it did I/O, and change them. And that means you have to figure out what the person was trying to do. Maybe it was simple, maybe it wasn't. In some days, they would actually have data be in packed form, where you compress it, so you get more data in less memory, and then uncompress it. And you've got to figure all that out. So we've gone way past that. Now it turns out Java's I/O is very well standardized, and quite intentionally so. So that was a mistake made years ago that we're not going to replicate. So now programs are machine-independent and platform-independent. Used to be even if you had the same machine, you would not be able to use necessarily the same programs. If you go back far enough, do you remember back when you had a PC, which is an IBM product, and Macintosh, which is, of course, an Apple product, and there would be two versions of a program, of the same program, like Microsoft Office. And you'd be able to run Microsoft Office on a Mac or on a PC, but not the same program. And the funny thing is that was true even if the underlying hardware had the same processor. As of what, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, Apple very wisely went to the Intel x86, which is what PC has been using for decades anyway. So now you have a computer that had the same underlying processor, the same source program, but there's still two versions of the program because the program is aware of the fact that you're running Windows or you're running Mac OS. Or if you're on something like a smartphone, maybe iOS or whatever the other, the various Android operating systems are. So we've kind of moved around that. That's another advantage of Java, is that it doesn't care what the operating system is. Many of you here are probably running Windows 7. Have you changed to Windows 10 yet? I got an invitation to change from Windows 7 to 10. Should I? It's fun, yeah, situation. Oh, it's fine. Okay, fine. It turns out one of the nice things about Mac is that they have a program called Parallels that allows you to run a Windows operating system on what amounts to be a Mac. So all of a sudden this differentiation is less effective. It's interesting, it didn't work the other way around, that it turns out the Windows people have never gone and come up kind of a reverse Parallels to say, hey, you can run Mac OS applications on a Windows system. I imagine they could do it, but business-wise, they don't want to do that. It makes people start using Macs too much, they might like it too much. So we've gone ahead and in compilers tried to make it as easy as possible to have programs be applicable as universally as possible. Big machines, small machines, Mac, IBM, PCs, whatever. And then you might say, oh, of course, that's obvious, any fool would do that. But it took us fools 40 or 50 years to figure out all the details of doing it. So now it turns out your programming skills are not dependent very much on what system you use. And if you change from Windows 7 to Windows 10 or run one of the versions of Mac OS or something, it's a fairly minor thing. Some systems are better than others in some ways, but it's not really a super big deal. It turns out that one of the things that's underappreciated, but perhaps you've seen it when you see Eclipse, is that compilers not only translate programs, they scrutinize programs to decide whether or not a program should be allowed or not. Now, this may seem like a minor thing, but all of a sudden, you as compiler writers get to be in a very interesting position. You're kind of like traffic cops. And by that, I mean there are all sorts of rules out about traffic. And one of the first things you do when you get a car is you figure out how much above the speed limit can I safely go. Now, what's your rule of thumb? And in fact, around Verona, maybe I should know that. How much above the speed limit can I safely go without likely getting a ticket? Oh, you're all aghast. You mean he goes above the speed limit? No, I'm just testing you. I would never break the law by going above the speed limit. If it says go 20 miles per hour, I go 20 miles per hour. Yes. So what's the rule around here? How safe can you be? That's right. This is a company town, isn't it? I'm sure Judy or one of the bigwigs calls the mayor and says, hey, my people have been bullied by your police. Stop. But usually, under my rule is 10 miles per hour, and I'm pretty safe on that. Interestingly enough, it varies a little bit. I had a student a few years back who had a red Camaro, and this poor fellow swore that if he went a half a mile above the limit, some copper would grab him and give him the ticket. Because red Camaros yell what? Irresponsible, young person racing around the area. And that was a pretty fast car, pretty nice car. Now, Camaros are generally, pretty good styling, and red kind of says, I'm fast. So that varied. But the point is, you get to do a similar sort of thing. You're not deciding whether to give tickets or not, but you're deciding whether to give error messages or not. And here's where you'll have to make some decisions. And it's not always clear which way to make the decision. So, for example, should you ever allow an incorrect program, apparently incorrect program, to actually be executed? So that means if I had something like A gets B divided by 0, and your compiler sees that, should it translate it, or it should give out an error message saying, no, you may not divide by 0? In fact, if you want, I don't know if you have iPhones, but anybody who has an iPhone, you can go and ask Siri what the value of 0 divided by 0 is, and you'll get a kind of an interesting response, let's say that way. Siri is known for having, usually is very helpful, but occasionally it takes you to task, and that's one where you do it. So should we do a Siri type thing and say, no, that's not allowed. You may not divide by 0. You can certainly make a case for it, but what's the case against it? Why should I allow that in a program? Now, part of it is he's a big guy, big boy, big girl. If they want to screw up, let them screw up. But there's perhaps something more fundamental than that. What do sometimes people use something like this for? No, not at all. You're going to get killed when that gets hit. Excuse me? Yeah, to throw an error. Sometimes you want to have something called a sanity check. It turns out more recent versions of Java and other languages have something called an assert. And an assert is simply a Boolean condition that says, I promise you on my scout's honor that this is true. And if it's false, Java takes you out and shoots you. That is, it throws an exception, and I think it's never caught. Why would you use an assert? Well, there's certain cases where you believe something's got to be true, and it's not. So, for example, here I could say A gets the square root of 25. And I'll assert that A is greater than or equal to 0. Why in the world would I do something that crazy? I'm taking the square root of 25, and I'm testing that it's greater than or equal to 0. Anybody remember their mathematics? What's the rule about square root? It's not always unique. It turns out there's a positive and a negative. So if the guy implementing square root was being a Weisenheimer, usually they don't do that. But they say, okay, you want a square root? I'll give you the unexpected one, which is minus 5. And remember, you could be using this 5 as something like an index or something. In Java and many other languages, a negative subscript value in an array is illegal. So you're saying, I'm trusting this guy to do the right thing by me, and if I end up getting something less than 0, that means you gave me the wrong root, and I'm saying, I'm not going on. You know, terminate the program, the world's over, because you gave me a bad value. So if I have something I can assert, I can do it, but this B over 0 is a way of doing the same thing. So that's an example. Turns out there are other things which are in between. Like, for example, should I allow you to write a program that never terminates? Suppose I write something like while true. And inside the block, I have nothing. So while true is true, and it's going to be true for a long time, keep looping. This, of course, is what people call an infinite loop. Usually, it's undesirable. If somebody wrote down a piece of code with this in it, should I say, hey, idiot, you've got an infinite loop in there. I'm not going to let you do it. I'm going to save you from yourself. It's one of these sort of situations there that I'll decide all the good things and bad things that are safe to do. Anything that's unsafe, you may not do. So obviously you cannot say, I'm giving you the case of why I would disallow it. Why would you perhaps want to allow it? Well, it turns out this kind of program actually exists and exists on your computer and mine. Does anybody have any idea where that program exists? And it's actually used on a regular basis. It's used in the operating system. And what does the operating system use it for? Well, one of the things it's used for is just for idleness. It's a situation. Remember, computers are immensely fast. Suppose I'm having a slow day and the operating system, the thing that runs programs, has run out of useful things to do. What's it going to do? It could stop. But if it stops, it means I got to restart it, and you don't necessarily want that. In most cases, you want your computer to keep going until you power it off, or sometimes you have some background thing that puts it to sleep to save energy. But in theory, you want the operating system to keep going. As the gentleman said, it's waiting for me to type. Remember, I'm a two-finger typer, so I probably type, I don't know what, 3, 4, 5 characters a second? So that means it's got 100 million instructions between type this guy and type that guy. And it's getting bored silly. Oh, come on, type the darn thing. I don't have 100 million cycles to waste. But you do. So what happens is actually the operating system has what they call an idle loop. And the idle loop says when nothing else to do, run a program that does nothing but twiddle its thumbs. And how does it twiddle its thumbs? Well, this is one way of doing it. Simply keep cycling back and forth. What happens is, as the gentleman suggested, eventually somebody will hit a key and that'll cause an interrupt. It's, oh, something's happened. Take the idle program off and now run the piece of code that reads the keyboard and says, okay, he just typed a letter, what shall I do with it? In some cases they'll buffer, or in other cases, if it's a character by character command, it'll actually react to it. So I had a game or something where I have various hotkeys and I said, hit a key and that means duck or jump or straddle or whatever, it would go and do it. So it turns out that I'm not necessarily as smart as I thought. I said, hey, that's an invalid program, and it's not. It's an unusual program. You can imagine I also might want to write a program like that to get some notion of the overhead of an operating system. If I have, this is surely the most trivial program you can imagine. If I have 100 or 1,000 trivial programs coexisting, can the operating system handle it? If it can't handle 100 of these kind of programs, it certainly can't handle 100 real programs that are bigger and more complex. So there are reasonable things to do it. But the whole point is we're now the traffic cop. We decide, hey, you get a ticket or not. Sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's not. But it's one of the things we end up doing because we're looking at a program deciding what's erroneous or not. And just like the cop, deciding what's illegal or not is not always that easy. It turns out also, compilers and compiler technology allow you to solve a problem which you may or may not be aware of, but it really is a very serious problem. How many of you are from small towns? And I'm not going to laugh at you or anything like that. A number of you. Is it still the case in many small towns people don't lock their doors at night? And it is true. And sometimes, you know, it's just, you know everybody in the neighborhood. They're all good people. You trust them. And sometimes that has terrible consequences. You certainly hear about cases where, you know, some criminal snuck in and the place wasn't locked and either stole or perhaps did physical harm to the people. So what's the point? You do a similar thing all the time when you download programs. You know, someone comes at you and says, hi, I'm a friendly program. Wouldn't you like to run me and see what I do? And many people naively say, yeah, and that's how malware and all sorts of other things infect the machine. How can we give you the benefit of saying, hey, there are plenty of good programs down there that are reasonable? And how can we go ahead and filter out the guys that are dangerous from the ones that aren't? It's not all that easy, but there's an example that Java, when you load a Java program, just doesn't take it for granted that it's a valid program. It does something that validates the program and says, if I were to run this program, could it do some bad things? And some bad things are not nearly as bad as you might imagine. So, for example, on many programs, this, by the way, is an old exam, which, remember, has always one sheet blank, so I'm getting some free paper. Oh, yeah. So it's the case that you generate some code, and you load an address and access data. And you do that all the time. An address is a pointer. It could be something that's been allocated from the heap via new. So you got a little bit of code that says load a address and access the data. But somebody goes in there and finds the code, and after the code is a file, it's changeable. It's just bits. And it goes in there and changes from adder, which is a valid adder, to some fixed address like 1,000. It turns out in many operating systems, there are certain addresses that have magic data. Like this, for example, might have had authorization. Am I an ordinary user? Or some operating systems, and I guess they have it around here, have something called the super user. And the super user is allowed to do things ordinary mortals are not allowed to do, like change file contents and so on. And if I go in there and take this program and I write in manually, not the address that I got from a new, but the address 1,000, assuming 1,000 is a very sensitive data, and I run this program, all of a sudden I can crash your program because I can now go in there and change something I ought not to have been able to do. What happens is that if I have something like the bytecode validator, it looks like something like that and it says, hey, wait a minute, you loaded an integer and used it as an address. Integers and addresses are kind of similar in that they're kind of like numbers, but they're not the same, certainly not in Java. You cannot take an address and do arithmetic on it. In C and C++, you sometimes can, but that makes things dangerous too. C++ is an industrial strength language that says, I'll let you do things, but if you screw up, it's your own problem, not mine. Oops. I can also do something that you would care about, namely protecting the intellectual property we have. In many cases, what programmers create are cool ideas to solve a problem. But here's the difficulty. Suppose I'm a drug manufacturer, and I come up with a great drug that does something. Say it reduces flu symptoms almost immediately. So, you know, you got the flu, you take the pill, boom, you're back to normal. Just think how much money you could make if you had that, because people get the flu, and it's really, I don't know, if you've never had the flu, you know, It's something really to look forward to. I've had it two or three times in my life, and I get a flu shot every year, so I don't get it a fourth time. But if you're a drug manufacturer, you keep the process very secret. But you're a software manufacturer, and here's the problem. You come up with this really cool way to do something, and you sell it in software. So what does your competitor do? Your competitor buys the software and looks at the instructions that you have in the translation, instruction by instruction by instruction, to figure out what he or she is doing that's so cool. And then, of course, they steal the idea. They won't admit it, but that's what they do. How can I protect myself? Well, there's something called obfuscation, and it's very similar to what the English word is, that says when I translate a program, I'm not going to translate it in the obvious way. I'm going to do all sorts of wild and crazy things to throw you off. It's sort of like when you think you're being, you know, in a police show, when you think you're being trailed by somebody, you don't take the obvious path. You go backwards and forwards and up and down and, you know, and try to throw them off your trail. You can actually do that with compiler technology if you want to protect your ideas. Something else is, you sell high-quality software. How do you protect from somebody trying to sell an imitation? Well, one way to do it is actually to put a watermark. Now, in this case, it's an electronic watermark, but it's similar to a watermark that you would see on paper or money. If you look at modern currency, in the United States and in most countries, they have a watermark where if you hold it up to the light, you see a special symbol saying that I didn't print this on ordinary paper. I printed it on very special paper that's watermarked, meaning it's less likely that this is counterfeit. If I want to go there and I pay a couple of $100, and I don't know, does anybody know what sort of money do you charge for your products? Are you allowed to tell that to an outsider? Excuse me? Oh, that. So suppose I come up there and I say, hey, you don't want to buy from Epic. I've got a copy of it here. I'll give it to you for half price. But of course, it may or may not be the genuine item. It's like somebody that has a stolen work of art or stolen car. You know, a stolen car can be sold cheaply if you, in fact, can't sell it. So what they do there in watermarking, they say, when I deliver the product, I'll have encoded in it, in a very unobvious way, information that says this is a valid Epic product. And what you would do is I'll give you for free a tester that will go in there and look at the product and check for a very special sequence of information that says, yeah, it passes the test. And of course, I'll keep very secret exactly how this watermarking is being done. But essentially, you can take the software, hold it up to the light, and say, yes, it's got a watermark. This is a genuine Epic product. Or no, that's a fake. Oh, I'm not going to buy it. I'm going to get the real deal and get what I want. So since people sell software for money, and people sometimes try to cheat by giving fake or bogus, the notion of watermarking ties into compilation. Not only do I generate a program, but I generate just enough information that allows you to say this is valid or this is not. What would that be? Well, for example, one rule you might have is that every 10th instruction in a piece of code is an add instruction. And it turns out if I don't need an add instruction, I put one in there. Now, this is so obvious that you wouldn't do it. But I'd look in there and say, add, and it would match up. So I'd look in at currency and say, okay, you know, it's a $100 bill. I'm sure none of you have ever seen a $100 bill. But assuming you do someday, whose picture is on a $100 bill? Excuse me? Yeah, right. So, I don't know, if you haven't seen the new $100 bills, you should see them. They are really spectacular. What happens is a large fraction of the $100 bills that are created by the Treasury actually go out of country. They're used as sort of something to keep under your mattress in case of an emergency for some ready cash that's easily exchangeable. And of course, that means $100 bills are very routinely counterfeited. But the new ones are really great. You know, I don't use hundreds very much myself. But if you're ever in a bank, you should get one just to see it. It is impressive in terms of all the anti-counterfeiting methodology they have. And if we do that for a $100 bill, we certainly should do it for pieces of software that surely sell for more than $100. We can use our technology to help have that product, to put something very subtle into the code we generated so that somebody who knows what the expected pattern is. And notice, by the way, the pattern can change. So it could be that today we have this pattern, but oh wait, when you bought the product yesterday, that had a different pattern. So it's rather much like a bank changing the combination to a lock quite routinely, or changing the password on your computer so that an old one can't slip by in future. See, how are we doing time? Well, I've been out, I'm over. What happened to... I'm sorry. I thought I had a clock set here. No, no, we're okay, I guess. No, I'm sorry. So I got a couple more things to say, and then we'll go ahead and take a break. So the situation here, there's also the issue, and I brought that up when we were talking last time about how various sorting algorithms might be paralyzed, is that modern processors have not just one processor, but actually several. The situation of having something called multi-core. And also multi-thread. And a processor I have, and you're probably not dissimilar to what many of you have, is it has two cores. That means there are actually two physical computer processors on the same chip. You can almost imagine cutting them in half and having two identical copies that have electronic connections. So when you buy a computer, you actually get two for the price of one. Because why? Because they're able to shrink them down to such a stage that they can give you the extra one almost for free. It's like going to Costco or Sam's Club or something, you know, where you can buy the world's biggest jar of mustard. And yet they have some of them. It must be, I don't know, maybe your cafeteria has it. They have jars of mustard about yay big. In a situation, you can actually buy those sort of things, and if you love mustard, you're going to be in heaven. But I don't know how long mustard lasts, and after a while, you know, you can kind of get sick of it. But in this sort of situation, you get extra cores, and it turns out a given processor can actually run several instruction streams simultaneously. That's called multi-threaded. So my processor, and it's by no means unique, it's a pretty ordinary one, has two cores and two threads. It can do four things simultaneously. So first thing you say to yourself, well, wait a minute. Yeah, let's wait more than a minute when I get another one of these suckers. You say, hey, wait a minute. I've got two processors, two threads. I can do four things at once. And that's almost like juggling. Anybody here a juggler? What's the rule? I mean, their situation. Is four about the limit to how far you can juggle? So here's the situation. I've got a program. Here's my big program. And I roughly cut it in quarters. And I say, here's the clever idea I'll do. I'll have processor one do that part, processor two, processor three, and processor four. Does that work? Probably not, almost certainly not, because of course the problem is P2 is going to have to start at a point where P1's already run and it had some data set up. But it turns out people can do some very clever things if you have the extra processing power and you're not using it otherwise. For example, suppose this was not chosen randomly, but it was chosen at a point where it does a whole computation and it decides we're going to go and have pizza today in cafeteria or we're going to have tacos today. And two choices. And if it's pizza, we're going to do one set of computations. If it's tacos, it's the other. Okay, I've got extra processors. What might I do to cover myself in this situation? I'd run both. I'm going to throw one of the results away, certainly, but I'm going to use the other. So what's happening while P1 is deciding, you know, says, do we do pizza tonight or do we tacos tonight? And there must be somebody in the cafeteria staff that makes those deep decisions. So he's going to say, if it's pizza, do this section, tacos, do that section. And all of a sudden now, with three processors, because now I'm going to have to do both parts, I can get, assuming these take roughly the same amount of time, I can cut the speed in half by using three processors. It's not as ideal as I wanted, but still not a half bad idea. So those are sort of things that people are investigating. There are ways we can take a program which looks sequential. And in fact, one of the deep questions we have going into the future is, should programming languages be sequential? What I mean by that, if you think about the definition of a program, it says do this, then do this, then do this, then go here or go there. But it's all very sequential. We try as an optimization to do things concurrently to speed things up, but the definition is concurrent. Should we have programming languages that are inherently parallel? The difficulty is it's not clear how to use those effectively and how you can guarantee that you get the right answer. Sometimes, like a great example of that would be what I had earlier where we took the square root of 25. I could get either a plus 5 or a minus 5. And if I don't know which in advance which I'm going to get, it's kind of hard for me to be consistent across the board. So if I said, oh, go ahead and compute a square root, And one guy computes one and one computes the other. Sometimes they get positive, sometimes they get negative. It's a situation there where it's a good spot to stop, I guess. So one of the innovations we're going to have this year is that it seemed last semester, we took 15-minute breaks, and those seemed to drag a little bit. So let's try changing it to 10 minutes. It's about quarter of, so about five of we'll resume. What we'll do is do another hour and a quarter, and that'll get us close to the final session. So we'll see you then about 5 minutes of 7:00.